This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Two senators want to change the name of one of the oldest football teams. You'll get $2 a signature if you help the Boughton Loretti ticket. And two times might not be enough for the affable felon, Buddy Cianci, who might just want to run Providence once again. It's Wednesday, which means it's time for our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. We will be tackling those stories with our panel, which includes, as always, Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Welcome back, Colin. Good to see you.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Also with us is Matt Dorenzo, Connecticut Group Editor for Digital First Media. Matt, it's good to see you once
again.
Good
morning.
And Dr. Kalila Brown-Dean, Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University. Good to see you once again, Kalila.
Good to be back.
First, though, we're going to start with the death penalty, which is back in the news this week. The Supreme Court ruled this week that Florida's rule setting an IQ bar of 70 to determine whether someone could be put to death was unconstitutional, with Justice Anthony Kennedy writing, "Intellectual disability is a condition, not a number." Florida wasn't the only state with the so-called bright line cutoff that the court found too rigid. Meanwhile, a botched Oklahoma execution has many states reconsidering whether lethal injection should be used going forward. Tennessee even passed a law recently legalizing the electric chair once again. President Obama has asked his attorney general to look into the application of the death penalty, and the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights has called for a moratorium in the U.S. There are continued questions about whether the drug cocktails used to kill inmates can be considered cruel and unusual. Oklahoma is putting off executions for 6 months while it considers its methods. Here's Oklahoma State Representative Mike Christian on NPR's Morning Edition earlier this month.
Eighth Amendment, the U.S. Supreme Court said it's okay to have a little bit of pain, whether it's through the electric chair, gas chamber, hanging, firing squad. So we may look at that, and some would say that's barbaric. I don't like using those kind of terms. Oklahoma's not barbaric. We just want justice, and we want justice served.
One of the problems pointed to in the Oklahoma case is a lack of traditional lethal injection drugs and the use of more experimental cocktails. Connecticut, with 11 inmates still on death row, says that it has run out of the drugs. Here, though, of course, it seems incredibly unlikely, drugs or not, that anyone will ever be put to death once again. In signing a 2012 repeal of the death penalty, Governor Dan Malloy said in the last 52 years, only two people have been put to death in Connecticut, and both of them volunteered for it. But the way the law was written, it opened up the door for at least one more death sentence in the state, and that came last week. Convicted triple murderer Richard Roskowski could still face death for a 2006 crime, which happened before the appeal. So how could a state that has abolished the death penalty still put someone on death row? Now, look at the latest Quinnipiac poll shows strong support in our state. Today, Where We Live, we'll consider the death penalty, and we want to hear from you, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive@wnpr.org, or you can tweet us at wherewelive. It's a long introduction because there's a lot to talk about this week. Colin, why don't you set us up with a little bit of history, though, first? I mean, how did we get here with a death penalty in the state, which has essentially been abolished but is still potentially could be applied?
Well, first of all, we have a long storied history with the death penalty, obviously going back to the 1600s, when, in fact, you could be put to death for all kinds of things. In fact, the first people put to death in Connecticut, you will be unsurprised to hear, were Native Americans. The first white person put to death in America to experience capital punishment was a man who suffered the misfortune. I think his name was George Spencer. He suffered the misfortune of having a pig be born that looked quite a bit like him. They both had only one working eye, thus a quote-unquote confirming that he had engaged in bestiality, the penalty for which was
death. And this was around when?
This would have been around the mid-1600s.
All right.
But this went on and on. And I mean, for example, you get into the late 18th century, people are still being executed for example, burglary. A three-time burglar would get executed. Part of that was it took a long time for Connecticut to have any prisons at all. The only way we ever punished people was to hurt them. So they'd, you know, rip off your ear, or they'd put you in stocks, or they'd hang you. They didn't have a whole lot of solutions. It wasn't until the establishment of Newgate Prison in Granby, which was a former copper mine, in the late 18th century that we actually got around to actually locking people up.
So with that history as a backdrop, it seems for a long time we'd been heading toward being one of the states that would repeal the death penalty. The law that was signed by Governor Malloy in 2012 essentially said we're not going to apply the death penalty moving forward. I think many of us were somewhat surprised that that might still apply to crimes that happened before 2012, and that's why Richard Roskowski is now just last week sentenced to death. Does this seem in any way incongruent to you, Colin, that this is being applied still after all this discussion and after this repeal?
I'm not a big fan of the death penalty, but I sort of get the problem, which is he got in the pipeline before the ban went down. I think it's incredibly unlikely that he will get the death penalty. I think it's incredibly unlikely that anyone will get the death penalty, including the two wrongdoers in the Cheshire murders. The history of this is that when a state bans the death penalty, nobody who's sitting there on death row gets executed. I don't think that's ever happened in the United States, and I doubt it'll happen here.
I like your thoughts on this, Kalila. This idea that the state could ban something and then still have 11 people on death row.
Well, I think it's incongruent when you think about the purpose of the death penalty, why the state decided to abolish it. So I understand the political expediency of saying the only way it could have gotten passed was by making it prospective. But if you hear the Oklahoma legislators say, we want justice, well, you can't have justice without fairness and transparency. And I think that's important, not just in Oklahoma, but in Connecticut as well. Colin talked about the history of the death penalty. We have to look at the history of lethal injection. We borrowed that from Nazi Germany. Hitler used lethal injection to get rid of people that he thought were physically or mentally inferior. So if that is our baseline for determining what we want to do in the state, I don't think anyone should be put to death in that way. I mean, it's no secret I'm not a fan of capital punishment at all. I'm not supportive of it in any case. But it is very incongruent for Connecticut to say we're not going to do it for future cases, but we're going to get rid of those currently there.
So instead of going back and trying to change the law, why not use this political opportunity with the Clayton Lockett botched execution, budget deficit, the shortage of drugs, and say, you know what, the law is the law, but this is never going to happen, so we're just going to stop fighting these appeals.
It costs a lot of money.
Spending money.
It costs a lot of money to fight these appeals. The state, in one of the recent appeals, the state spent $1 million on one expert witness.
We could raise more money than Keno would generate.
Right. I mean, that expert witness cost us 10 judicial pensions for 1 year per late in life judge.
Is this a new form of currency?
Yes,
here?
Exactly.
It's judicial a benchmark. Pension. It's a benchmark. We're talking about the death penalty here. Well, before we bring on Mike Lawler from the state to address this, I mean, how realistic is that, do you think, Matt? It seems in many ways practical, given some of the considerations you're talking about and the need, frankly, for the state to save a little bit of money here and there.
It might be realistic to quietly do that, but I don't know if you could do it quietly, because the reason why the law wasn't written that way in the first place is because politicians couldn't look Dr. Pettit in the eye and other victims who had gone through the due process and had this punishment meted out against the person who did horrible, horrible things to their family. So you can't do it. You can't do it in an election year either. You know.
Let's go to Mike Lawler. He's Connecticut's Undersecretary for Criminal Justice Policy and Planning. He joins us by phone for a few minutes. Mike Lawler, welcome back to Where We Live. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning, guys. I apologize for the fire engine behind me.
Oh, no worries. We can hear you just fine. Before we get to some other things, I'll just ask you, Connecticut, it seems, has no lethal injection drugs on hand. I've heard you say that that's not surprising. Most states don't have any. Should we be surprised that Connecticut couldn't put someone to death if they had to?
Well, just to be clear, Connecticut doesn't have the drugs that were traditionally used in lethal injection because they were manufactured in Europe. The manufacturer has basically banned their use for this purpose. So the states that have conducted executions have sort of improvised going to these compounding factories. But at the moment, we don't have a drug that can be used for this purpose. If and when the time comes, we'll have to, you know, figure out how to obtain such a drug. The law requires that before that can happen, that the Commissioner of Corrections, together with the Commissioner of Public Health, has to develop a protocol about that particular drug. And we'll see. The federal courts obviously are going to answer the question of what drugs can be used and what drugs can't be used, and we'll wait for them to decide.
In the Oklahoma case, essentially, they'd arrived in a cocktail of drugs, and whether or not it had to do with the drugs that were administered or the way in which they were administered, it seemed as though that didn't work. How confident could we be, Mike Lawler, that this state or any other state could come up with a way to execute someone by lethal injection that would meet some sort of a constitutional standard of not being cruel and unusual?
Yeah, that's the question. And I think the federal court's going to have to answer that question before any more executions are carried out.
I want to play a little bit of tape here from NPR's Weekend Edition. This is Ty Alper, a clinical professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, who's represented death row inmates.
I am opposed to the death penalty, and I don't think that we should be executing people. But if we are, and particularly if we're going to do it by way of procedures that are shrouded in secrecy, that use experimental combinations of drugs that have never been used before, then we need to have competent medical personnel involved.
And this, Colin, points to, I think, one of the great paradoxes of all this. In order to come up with a series of lethal drugs that need to be injected a certain way to execute someone, it requires some medical precision that clearly in the case of Oklahoma just was not there. Doctors, nurses, trained medical professionals recuse themselves from this exact sort of behavior. It seems like we're at a crossroads. There's almost no way the medical profession and even drug makers would get behind lethal injections. But in order to carry out an execution of this way, you need medical professionals, it seems.
Right. I mean, well, first of all, that would be a wonderful solution if there just nobody would cooperate with this. I'm not quite sure that that's going to be the case. And there are states where they use different kinds of cocktails. There are states where they essentially sedate the person to death. My guess is, I mean, I'm like Kalilah, I don't support the death penalty. But my guess is if somebody wants to do this, they're going to be – some state wants to do this, they will find a way. You know, as Mort Saul said, you got to execute people. How else are they going to learn?
We're talking about the death penalty here in the program. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. In an email, Jesse asks, is it true that the death penalty costs more than life in prison? If so, can you explain why that is? Mike Lawler, you probably get asked this a lot. Can you answer Jesse's question?
Yeah, it's definitely true. It's been studied extensively, especially down in North Carolina. I think at the end of the day, they figured it cost about seven times as much to execute somebody than it would have cost to just lock them up forever and throw away the key. So it's definitely, I mean, you mentioned yourself, in the case of one expert, over $1 million of state money. The appeals go on and on and on. It's been more than 52 years since we've executed anybody who didn't want to be executed here in Connecticut. And the 11 guys on death row all have appeals, and they're extremely complicated and extremely expensive. So some of them have been on death row for more than 25 years. And so that cost has to be calculated into the cost of, you know, compared to just keeping them in jail forever. So,
well, Matt Dorenzo just a moment ago suggested something very simple for the state. Just don't fight these appeals. Just don't actually spend the millions and millions of dollars. Could the state take that stance?
It could. That's up to the Division of Criminal Justice, the state's attorneys. They're independent of the governor and others, and that's an option for them. But so far, they've continued to pursue these death sentences.
Kalilah?
Well, I'm thinking about the cost of this, and I'm someone who advocates for families. The millions of dollars that we're spending on experts could go to victim services so that families could get some sort of mental health treatment that is sustainable to regain that sense of normalcy and rebuild their lives. And I think that if we're talking about transparency, we're talking about wanting a smaller government, there's a much more efficient way to channel that money and really help the people who need it so that we're not throwing away dollars fighting these cases. We're actually strengthening communities and maybe preventing future crime.
One thing I think that we have to look at, though, Matt, and I mentioned it in my introduction, at Kalilah's University, their polling institute always asks a question about the death penalty. When asked just broadly, do you support the death penalty? Some 62% of Connecticut residents say, yeah. When asked, you know, do you support the death penalty or life in prison? It's about split. It's hard to change a law when the people of Connecticut seem to think it's a good idea.
Well, the law was already changed. I think that this is why the governor and others won't use the bully pulpit that they have to urge the state's attorneys to stop doing that. And that's why I think the political will won't be there to take this further. But
yeah, I mean, typically you do see that disparity that you just cited. If you ask people whether they favor the death penalty or whether they support abolition of the death penalty, the death penalty, you know, usually garners around 60-65% support. When you give them a choice between that and life without parole, the number goes way down. This time in this particular poll in this particular state, it didn't go down low enough to constitute maybe the kind of mandate that would create the kind of condition that I'm not even sure that what Matt's talking about is possible, although the same scenario occurred to me. But, you know, and it might be a question to ask Mike, too. I mean, even given the fact that the prosecutors operate independently of the governor's office, is there any kind of colloquy about this? Is there any way in which this ever gets discussed?
Well, you know, the pros and cons of the death penalty have been discussed extensively, right? And I think, you know, we try, when I say we, I mean the executive branch, we try and be cautious when we're dealing with the judges or prosecutors and respect their independence and their autonomy. So asking them to do things is in terms of disposition of cases, is not something we get into. But I want to point out one thing, just to be clear. Of the six states that repealed the death penalty in the last few years, all of them did it prospectively. So it's nothing unique to Connecticut. Mm-hmm. There's guys on death row in New Mexico and Maryland, et cetera, because those death penalties were repealed prospectively.
Can I say one thing about public opinion? After the Pettit trials, with all the emotion around that, you know, you might have taken a poll and found 75% supported the Edith Prague punishment for it. But that doesn't mean that the state could or should or would do it.
I want to go to a quick phone call here. Don's in Newington. Hi, Don. Go ahead.
Hi.
You're on the air.
This is actually Bob in Newington.
Oh, Bob. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Please, go ahead.
I'm just having trouble understanding the problem people are having with this drug cocktail everybody's concocting. When the reality is, if your dog is terminally ill and they can't do anything for him, we've been putting them to sleep for, 70, 80 years. No problem, no question that this is cruel and unusual. And you bring them to the vet, you fill them full of phenobarb, they go to sleep, they don't wake up. What's the whole drug cocktail thing? But, why is there an issue here?
But Bob is asking the question, and Bob, thank you very much for that. Bob is asking the question, Mike Lawler, why don't we just use those same drugs that we've been using for many years to put our dogs peacefully to sleep?
Because the people who make those drugs will not permit them to be used for executions of human beings. That's the problem at the moment.
Mike Lawler, join us by phone. He's Connecticut's Undersecretary for Criminal Justice Policy and Planning. Always good to talk to you, Mike. Thanks so much for being here.
Okay, guys. Thanks.
Kalila, just before we move off of the subject and take a break, I know that you've written about the death penalty for the New York Times and other places. And one of the things that we haven't addressed here is, we've now added another white man to death row here in Connecticut, probably the last person we will ever add to death row. In other states across this country, the question of the death penalty and, frankly, the question of criminal justice is one that is often about race. That's something that's not really so much of this conversation right now, but it probably needs to be said.
Even here in Connecticut, the conversation or the demographic is really about race. It's about socioeconomic class, and it's also about region, so that if you commit a murder in an urban center, you're more likely to receive the death penalty less likely to receive the death penalty than in a suburb, because we feel like we expect that in Bridgeport or Hartford. If it happens in Greenwich or if it happens in West Hartford, that's shocking to us. But if we look at overall, blacks make up about 13% of the total U.S. population, but make up about 65% of people sentenced to death. And when we look at patterns in terms of intra-racial violence, if you are an African-American or Latino convicted of killing someone who is white, you are significantly more likely to receive the death penalty. And so if we're saying the death penalty is about justice for victims and for families, it's really about certain victims and certain families. And that, again, is why I think it's a system that's irreparably broken.
And that is at argument right now, too. You probably know more about this than I do, but the case, the sort of Cobb et al. Case that was decided actually sort of in favor of the death penalty against the defendants at the Superior Court level late last year, which I assume – I think it's a waiting appeal. It may go directly to the state Supreme Court. It may go to appellate court before that. But that is a case in which – in fact, the million-dollar witness was an expert witness for the state about the racial disparity issue, and the defendants had hired their own witness, John Donahue of Stanford University, arguing actually that there are racial disparities. I just quickly would interject that Lawrence Goodhart, in his excellent history of capital punishment in Connecticut, The Solemn Sentence of Death, found racial disparity as he analyzed 17th and 18th century executions in Connecticut. It seemed as though if you were African American or Native American, you were much more likely to be hanged for a similar offense that if you were white, you would wind up in the stocks or something.
So this is in the 17th and 18th centuries. Some things do not change. Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, Dr. Kalila Brown, dean from Quinnipiac University, Matt Dorenzo from the New Haven Register, and many other newspapers here in the state. We're going to be taking more of your calls as we move forward here, and we'll be talking a bit more about state politics, some teams being formed, a little pickup game around the governor and lieutenant governor's races. If you want to join us in the wheelhouse, it's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's Wednesday, so that means it's the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We're going to move to a quick update on 2014 elections, see how some of the teams are taking shape. Let me introduce you to our panelists. Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, is here as always. What's on your show this afternoon, Colin?
Well, Mr. Dankosky, as you know, we've had in our midst for a few months now a young man named Alan Yu, who's here on a Kroc Fellowship, which allows distinguished young journalists to rotate around among various public radio entities. So, Alan, this is his last week, and he's producing a show for us this week about today about how comic book culture became mainstream culture, how the people who were sort of nerds and outcasts 20 years ago basically call the tune. And we included in this will be Ghostbusters, and we will actually have two people in here in Ghostbusters uniforms because we've had some problems here in the building. And,
don't cross the streams. That's all I have to say.
Exactly.
So that's coming up at 1 o'clock this afternoon on the Colin McEnroe Show. Matt Dorenzo is here. He's Connecticut Group Editor for Digital First Media. And Dr. Kalila Brown-Dean, she's Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University. Take your calls at 860-275-7266. As we move to the governor's race, Mayor Mark Boughton announced his running mate early in the campaign, at least his first running mate. Groton Town Councilwoman Heather Summers was running with Boughton but decided to make her run for lieutenant governor alone. Here's Mark Boughton on WFSB's Face the State with Dennis House.
Well, we've got Plan B, right? I didn't stay mayor 13 years because we didn't plan for contingencies. So we've been talking very closely with Mayor Mark Loretti, who's a Shelton mayor, and we will be forming an alliance. He'll be dropping into the lieutenant governor's race.
Okay, so that's Mark and Mark running together. Matt, what can you tell us about the Mark and Mark team?
This is crazy interesting and I think bad for Mark Boughton. This scramble to get another running mate, you know, not every candidate is choosing to run with someone. Boughton is doing this because he needs Mark Loretti's money to pool with his so he can qualify for public financing and have enough money to run a gubernatorial race. It's very unlikely that Mark Loretti has a shot in the lieutenant governor's race. And the interesting background there in terms of why Boughton – how Boughton would align with this guy is we just ran a story this morning about kind of the good news and the bad news about the Loretti statewide candidacy. He's no longer the subject of a federal probe that had been going on for more than a decade and has been cleared, so to speak, or not being charged. But the state is being introduced to the fact that the Shelton mayor, two people went to jail for bribing him, giving cash and home improvements for influence on developments and in the other case, an Aspen vacation rental. And so while he was never charged himself, other people went to jail for giving him money in exchange for influence. Like Roland, like Eddie Perez, like a long stretch of Connecticut public officials. And Boughton said, well, he kept getting reelected and, so never charged.
Well, he kept getting reelected. And I know and Mark Boughton has had some questions around around his office as well and in freedom of information, attempts to get information out of there. Before I get to Colin, Kalila, what do you think of this pairing, the Mark and Mark pairing?
It's bizarre. It's a bizarre pairing. Particularly, the GOP needs a ticket, if that's what you want to create, that can capture the state and appeal to various constituencies within the party, within the state. This does not do that. Mark Squared does not do that at all. I sort of thought Marky Mark and Funky Mark was the morning.
Marky Mark
that,
is good. Mark
I didn't
Squared
want to date
may
myself.
Be better. Yeah.
I don't want to date myself. But it's very peculiar because you wonder, I get the financial incentive, and I think that says a lot about the nature of elections in this country overall, that it's, where can I get the money as opposed to is this person aligned with me? Do we share the same vision for the state? But I think there needs to be a bipartisan consensus in Connecticut that we want to avoid any appearance of wrongdoing. Both parties have had some challenges with that. And this ticket does not give people that confidence. Just because one is no longer the subject of a probe does not mean that there was no, misconduct there or ground for concern.
Well, one thought that occurred to me once I realized that he'd switched down to the lieutenant governor line is that maybe Mark Loretti had become a cooperating witness and was now entering the witness protection program. Lieutenant governor would be a good place to hide, I think. This is, first of all, I would say remarkable and probably unprecedented in the history of Connecticut that three people came out of the convention qualifying for a lieutenant governor primary. This is, a job that Kevin Sullivan practically faked his own death to get out of going into. You know, I mean, it is the famous bucket of warm spit. So three people wanted it enough to pull through a convention. And then Loretti dropped down. So now we have a fourth. I mean, it's kind of unheard of. I actually sort of think I grant everything that Matt and Kalilah have said so far. In some ways, this is kind of good for the Republicans that they have a lot of people who are interested in doing a lot of things, which seems like a rather low bar to clear. But for the Republicans, it's not. You know, the idea that they have some pretty competitive races, that they have a lot of people around, building up some visibility. Most of them are going to lose a lot of things this time, but they'll be that much more viable down the road. You know, Loretti's obviously got his problems, and I just don't think he's going to be much of a factor in all this. The other thing that I would quickly say is this is another example of how the citizens' elections program is still playing out. It's so new that we just don't know, you know, what behaviors it's going to engender. So this time around, in the ways that Matt was saying, it just created this really odd situation where Boughton and Loretti probably would be at pains to avoid one another under ordinary circumstances, but because in fact, Boughton needs Loretti's money in order to qualify for public financing. And meanwhile, he's willing to help Loretti get signatures, which Loretti needs to actually get on the ballot for the primary. You just have these things that happen that you couldn't predict them. We just have to watch them play out.
Well, and let's just explain how he's going to help his running mate get these signatures. He's actually offering a little something.
If anyone needs some extra money, Mark Boughton is offering $2 per valid signature. So if you want to go out and help get Loretti on the ballot.
Okay, so if you're a Republican, a registered Republican, mm-hmm. you can go help get signatures for Mark Loretti, and he's giving $2 per signature?
That's right.
And that's, like, legal? That's cool?
I believe it's been done in the past.
It happens quite often. I mean, there are entire companies that's their job to do that. But, you know, is this sort of their approach to creating jobs in Connecticut? Will this be sustainable economic growth? But here again, even though it's legal, it is so dangerous to do that because it gives the impression that we're buying votes or we're buying support. And even again, if it's completely legal, I think you have to be very cautious about that.
It doesn't – I mean, maybe I'm wrong, Colin. It doesn't give the impression that we're buying support. It actually is that we're buying support. I mean
– signatures.
You're buying signatures, but you're buying signatures in order to cash in on federal or state support.
It's an unattractive practice, but I think if Mark Boughton were here, John, he'd tell you that he didn't stay mayor of Danbury for 13 years without being willing to spend a little money once in a while to get things done.
Well, maybe we'll get the mayor on quickly. I will say John McKinney, who is also running for governor, is going to be on our program next Tuesday, and you can always ask him questions here on Where We Live as we continue our Where We Vote series. He's teamed up with David Walker. Of course, there's a dust-up around the convention around David Walker and Penny Bacciocchi, who is coming out of the convention as the endorsed candidate for lieutenant governor. What's interesting here, Colin, is that we seem to have formed these teams. It's Mark Squared and then John McKinney running with David Walker. And then Tom Foley and Penny Bacciocchi seem to have been forced to sit together on the prom float and don't exactly love each other all that much.
Yeah, it's not clear whether they don't love each other that much or whether Tom Foley just has such huge commitment problems that he can't love anybody. And, of course, I mean, Boughton was his running mate last time around. He really detests Mark Boughton now. So, you know, it just could be – I mean, I don't know of any actual animosity or division existing specifically between Foley and Bacciocchi. I see it, I mean, unless there's something I'm missing or I don't know about, which is very possible, I see it more that Foley just doesn't see any reason to commit to anybody right
well,
now.
Well, in the last time he ran, he didn't run with anyone either. Wilson, right. Foley and Boughton kind of independent. Well, Boughton was aligned with Fedeli, but they ran.
Right. He'll meet his lieutenant governor.
Exactly. Yeah.
Running mate after the primary.
Well, right. But before we move on, Colin paints such an attractive picture of the job of lieutenant governor that I wonder why anyone, Kalilah, would even want to get in on this. Does it matter, frankly, who's running on a ticket or not, who the potential next lieutenant governor of the state of Connecticut is?
I think it's a personality issue. It depends on who that person is. You know, overall, lieutenant governors aren't the names that we know. They aren't like a vice president that's doing a lot of, decision making in the background. It's especially for Connecticut. It's not like the lieutenant governor is really angling toward a national position. So in that way, it becomes sort of a hollow victory. But, you know, again, it's a bizarre combination if, in fact, you want to secure the party and you want to secure that vote.
I mean, it depends. You have to look at the things we've seen recently. I mean, I don't know about you, but I have an app on my phone. Whenever there's an emergency, I can actually point it at Nancy Wyman's face, and it'll tell me how much trouble we're really in, you know, because she's always standing next to Dan Malloy looking either kind of grim or hopeful or something like that. The app gives me a sense of my chances of survival of that particular disaster. But, you know, they don't do that much else. The theory often is that they compensate for something. So Nancy Wyman is a very popular person. People really like her. So guess what she's compensating for? You know, it's that kind of thing.
We're talking with Colin McEnroe, Dr. Kalila Brandine, and Matt Dorenzo here on The Wheelhouse and Where We Live. You know, we talk an awful lot about politics here in the state, and even just in this last conversation, we end up talking a little bit about corruption. That is something that Connecticut seems to have done very well, but not as well as the mayor of Providence. Here's Buddy Cianci talking to a political reporter, Ian Donis, about whether or not he'd consider another run for the mayor of Providence job.
Would I do it? The simple answer is, yeah, I'd do it if I had a reason to do it. I wouldn't run for history or anything like that or for any other reason. I'd run if I could make a difference. And I've been thinking a lot about that.
I want to welcome in Ian Donis, who is the political reporter for Rhode Island Public Radio. His story this week at 73, Buddy Cianci considers yet another run for mayor of Providence. Ian, welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Happy to be with you.
So, first of all, for those of us here in Connecticut who don't know the story of Buddy Cianci, and we talk about our Eddie Perez's and we talk about our Joe Ganims and John Rowlands, and we think we've got corruption down cold, explain who Buddy actually is.
Well, Buddy's kind of a larger-than-life figure. He emerged in the 1974 race for mayor of Providence as a Republican, which was very unusual in the Democratic bastion of the Northeast. He actually was the anti-corruption candidate, kind of ironic in terms of what followed later in his career. He has a gift for political showmanship and helping people to feel good about themselves. He had some success in raising Providence's fortunes. Then he was forced from office in 1984 after he assaulted a man he suspected of sleeping with his estranged wife. It was a very dramatic incident in which Cianci was accused of using a fireplace log, a lit cigarette, an ashtray, and these other things as part of this assault. He resigned the office, went into exile as a talk radio host, staged a remarkable comeback in 1990, won a narrowly divided three-way race to win, regain the mayor's office as an independent, and presided over the nationally hyped Providence Renaissance through the 1990s until the FBI raided Providence City Hall in 1999, raising the curtain on what became known as the Plunderdome investigation. Cianci was ultimately convicted of a single count of racketeering conspiracy, did about 5 years in federal prison, and got out in 2007, became a talk radio host again, and as we said earlier, is now looking at another possible run for mayor at age 73 and after fighting his way back from colon cancer.
So, of course, if he's going to run once again, it must mean that a lot of people out there still love Buddy. What is it about this guy that continues to attract people, even given some of the things that he's alleged to have done or he's been convicted of actually doing in the job?
Well, he appeals to some people as this kind of lovable rogue. Like, yes, he might have the capability to be an SOB, but he's our SOB. And he's a very bright, very glib guy who's good at using smoke and blue mirrors to raise the fortunes of a place. He was good at highlighting different things in Providence, like the zoo and Trinity Repertory Company and the restaurants, to kind of lift the self-esteem of people. And people felt that, some people at least, felt like it was a worthwhile trade-off that, you know, maybe cut a few corners, but he also did a lot to raise Providence's fortunes. And we should note, of course, also there were other Providence residents and Rhode Islanders who took a much dimmer view of Cianci. And testimony at his trial in 2002 depicted kind of a dark city where the needs of school children in some cases were going unmet to the way city government was operating. So it was not a universal level of support for him, but he is a remarkable political character, a very charismatic guy.
We're talking with Ian Donis, who's a political reporter for Rhode Island Public Radio here in the Wheelhouse. I'd like to just get some thoughts from our panel. And Colin, you've covered an awful lot of the corruption here in the state. And as I tick off just the municipal corruption, places like Bridgeport and Joganum, Eddie Perez in Hartford, and Phil Giordano and others in Waterbury, and then, of course, John Rowland. One of the things that we keep coming back to is it seems as though we haven't gotten a whole lot of bang for our corruption buck. These places still struggle in many ways, despite having people who led them and took a lot of money for themselves, potentially, but then also could have done a lot of good for the city. The Buddy Cianci story is a little different. This is seen as the Renaissance city, the city that Hartford and Waterbury wishes in many ways it could be. What does Buddy Cianci tell us about corruption here in Connecticut and political figures here?
Yeah, I'm not sure you can compare that. Because of everything that he just said, It's very difficult to compare sort of town to town, city to city. Every city has its own character. And I completely agree that in the case of Providence, Buddy has come to symbolize a certain kind of local indomitability. You know, and every new every new problem, whether it's colon cancer or a federal probe, just seems to kind of confirm this. He's like a wasp lying on the ground that you're throwing hunks of gravel at, you know, and the wasp keeps rising back up to fly up and sting you again. And so, I mean, it really is. I think it's sort of hard to look at that and compare it to Bridgeport, compare it to Waterbury, compare it to some of these other, compare it to Hartford. The reality is, in those cases, those people went away. At least we hope and think they went away. Phil Giordano, I can guarantee you, is never coming back. And I'm guessing most of the other ones don't come back. So other than that, I think other than establishing AM Talk Radio as the last refuge of scoundrels, I'm not sure there's too much bleed from Cianci into Connecticut.
Has anyone done the definitive critique or comparison of the quality and ratings of John Rowland's show and Buddy Cianci's show?
That's actually something we should look at. Was he a popular talk show host, Ian Donis?
Yes, he is very popular. He's seen as the lead talker in the AM market and commands a pretty hefty six-figure salary for his work on radio and TV. He is a draw. He's well-wired into his sources. But we should also note that some of the shine has come off the Providence Renaissance. The city's current mayor inherited an unexpected $110 million deficit when he came into office in 2010, and those of us in Rhode Island still love Providence, but it is a city that has its challenges.
Well, I grew up in Virginia, very close to D.C., and people give D.C. residents grief about Marion Barry. Why do people care about Marion Barry? You know, no one gave him a radio show. But it seems to be this pattern, and I seem to think he's our SOV would make a great bumper sticker for a campaign. But it says a lot about our level of forgiveness and who we think is capable of redemption and what it means to be a public figure. Corruption isn't this gray, murky area, at least it seems here. But voters seem to be willing to give a third, fourth, and fifth chance.
If you want to read his report, you can go to Rhode Island Public Radio's website. We'll also link to it on ours, WNPR.org. Ian Donis is political reporter for Rhode Island Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us, Ian. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Take care.
When we come back from our break, we'll be moving to Native American issues, including two U.S. senators from Connecticut calling for a change of the name of the Washington Redskins. We'll figure out how that lines up against some of what's also going on in Washington around the Bureau of Indian Affairs. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, singer-songwriter Carrie Powers will join us to talk about her career as a roots musician. We'll preview some of the music she'll be playing at the Heart Folk Festival coming up this Saturday. We'll also listen back to our visit with Sean Spellman of the band Quiet Life. He's a New London native, and he's back in the area with his band. A little bit of local music here on Where We Live tomorrow. I hope you can join us. Today, it's our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. Joining us in studio, as always, Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, Dr. Kalila Brown-Dean, Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University, and Matt DiRenzo, Connecticut Group Editor for Digital First Media. Senators Chris Murphy and Richard Blumenthal joined 48 other U.S. senators calling on the NFL to change the name of the Washington, D.C. franchise. This has renewed the debate over the Washington Redskins name. Here's former NFL head coach Mike Holmgren weighing in on a Seattle sports radio station.
You think they should change the name of the Redskins?
Absolutely.
Why?
Well, because of what it signifies and what it means to so many people. I'm not talking football fans. I'm talking about Native Americans and all that. Yeah, just change the name. Big deal. Change the name.
Joining us now is Simon Moya-Smith, who's a writer, activist, and citizen of the Oglala Lakota Nation. He's a columnist and reporter for Indian Country Today Media Network and a contributor to CNN Opinion. Simon, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining us. Simon, hi, are you there? Let's try to get Simon back on the line, and in just a moment we will. The thing that's interesting to me about this, Colin, is that as we hear from Senators Murphy and Blumenthal deciding to jump on the train here, along with a lot of other U.S. senators, and saying that we should change the name of the Washington Redskins because it's indeed offensive, there's other things happening in Washington right now. The Bureau of Indian Affairs released a draft version of new tribal recognition rules. One change to the latest draft says the tribes whose bids have been rejected in the past must be approved by those who have previously opposed them. This change could affect several Connecticut-based tribes that have been seeking federal recognition for years now. Essentially, it seems as though these U.S. senators want to do something good for Native American people, but on the other hand, they're looking at the possibility of new tribes and saying, nah, that's a fast.
Well, I mean, first of all, tribal recognition is a morass, a morass in which I think it's probably, first of all, a morass which closely parallels a lot of other things that happen in Washington, in which lobbyists get involved, special interests get involved. And so I think it would be, most people would agree with the statement, a number of tribes have been recognized, or a number of groups of people have been recognized as tribes that probably shouldn't have been, and a number of people who should have been recognized as tribes have great difficulty with it. It is impossible, of course, now to unthread it from the casino issue. I mean, it just they now just march hand in hand. Which is kind of a shame because these things should be decided on their own merits. But the casino issue not only brings up all kinds of local protectiveness issues, but it also injects a lot of money into the process so that you have groups of people suddenly being backed by a Donald Trump type. Well, that was a bad example considering what he said about the Mashantuckets. But you have people being backed by wealthy interests who couldn't give a whoop in the high wind about tribal recognition, except insofar as it opens the floodgates to cash.
Well, I think that, you know, recognizing and affirming someone's identity shouldn't be tied to economic concerns. But as Colin said, it's very much the case. I also think it's a bit hypocritical for the NFL to condemn comments made by Donald Sterling and say that they expect the NBA to intervene and to continue to use a name that is just as, if not more offensive, as the things that Sterling said. So to continue that and to make it a political and economic question, I think says a lot about the way we devalue Native American tribes, Native American members, and that history.
And there's even been some people in the media, Matt Dorenzo, who've decided on their own, we're just not going to use the name anymore. We're going to call it the Washington Football Team. And they're going out on their own and saying, you know, we just don't use this word anymore.
Well, you know, we take great care on a lot of other stories to be careful about the language we use. So why wouldn't we do that? You know, a couple weeks ago, Chris Healy, a Republican strategist, he used this point to mock Senator Murphy and Blumenthal about the Redskins name, but he pointed out that a lot of our high schools in Connecticut have names like the Killingly Red Men, the Indians, the Red Raiders. If you go to Watertown High School, you go to the swimming pool there, you'll see Watertown Indians and you'll see scalp 'em on the side of the wall. Highly inappropriate message for our kids, not to mention anything. So I think we have to soul search.
One by one, high schools across America are making their own decisions.
Right. High schools and colleges as well. I want to bring back in Simon Moya-Smith, who I think we've established a line. Hi, Simon. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'm wondering quickly if you can just say what you think it means that these U.S. senators have signed this petition asking for the Redskins to change the name.
I think it's a move in the right direction, but I think what the problem is people think it's just the Redskins. We're talking about the dehumanization of Native Americans as mascots. When you see me as a mascot, you don't see me as your neighbor. You don't. I mean, there's this idea that if a Native American walks into the room, we're supposed to have long hair and walk in with moccasins and bows and arrows. What we're trying to establish is that we're humans, we're your fellow citizen. And by dehumanizing us as mascots, it makes it difficult for the other issues. And that's a big argument people like to make. There are bigger issues in Indian country. Well, when we talk about them, nobody's listening. We interrupt somebody's sports, they begin to listen because that's their privilege. They get to go and just paint their face red, go to a Cleveland Indians game and enjoy themselves. But as a Native American, if I go and say, hey, that's not right, oh, you're being too PC. So this is not just about Redskins. This is about rehumanizing the Native American in our own country. And I think people need to remember that. This is a dehumanization of the indigenous peoples of this country who have been discriminated since your people arrived.
One thing I have to ask is there are certainly some cases, including the Seminole tribe in Florida, that have made agreements with college football teams and said, you can indeed use our name. You can use our imagery. Does this set back the cause that you're talking about, Simon?
Yeah, I really think it does, because even though that it's coming from a good place and like, look, we're going to give you permission to use our likeness as your mascot, it doesn't stop the kids from being in from.
I think we've just lost Simon once again. I'm sorry that we lost his line. We just have a moment or so left. I'm wondering if we could just pick up on a quick thread about that. I mean, Simon, as you were saying before, very passionate in defending Native Americans, saying that as long as we have names like this, we're not having these more important conversations about this issue.
I think, as Simon is saying, it's an entry point to at least think about what are the ways that we historically and systematically have overlooked Native American communities and not allow them to be viewed as fully Americans. And so if changing this name can start that national conversation, I think it's something we should do.
I was planning to take this conversation with Simon all the way to the end of the program. We do have a few minutes left, but we're going to leave you with some unfortunate news. We learned this morning that Maya Angelou, the poet, died at the age of 86 at her home in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. She was 86 years old. We'd like to play for you Maya Angelou reading her poem, And I Still Rise, back in 2007.
You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me in the very dirt, but still like dust, I'll rise. Does my sassiness upset you? Why are you beset with gloom? Just because I walk as if I have oil wells pumping in my living room. Just like suns and like moons, with the certainty of tides. Just like hope springing high, still I rise. Did you want to see me broken? Bowed head and lowered eyes, shoulders falling down like teardrops, weakened by my soulful cries. Does my sassiness upset you? Don't take it so hard just because I laugh. As if I have gold mines digging in my own backyard. You can shoot me with your words. You can cut me with your lies. You can kill me with your hatefulness. But just like life, I'll rise. Does my sexiness offend you? Oh, does it come as a surprise that I dance? As if I have diamonds at the meeting of my thighs. Out of the huts of history's shame, I rise. Up from a past rooted in pain, I rise. A black ocean leaping and wide. Welling and swelling, I bear in the tide. Leaving behind nights of terror and fear, I rise. Into a daybreak miraculously clear, I rise. Bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave. I am the hope and the dream of the slave. And so, naturally, there I go rising.
That's the voice of Maya Angelou, who died at the age of 86. We just have a moment. Kalila Brandine, a thought?
Dr. Angelou said that the death of an elder is like the burning of a library, because so much unwritten history gets buried with them. I hope that we'll reclaim her works, listen to those words, and apply them to the issues we're facing today.
Colin?
If she'd done nothing else but write I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, that would have been a major accomplishment. I know a young African-American woman who's reading it right now. But really, on the pulse of mourning, her inaugural poem in 1993 for Bill Clinton, linking, first of all, that back to the tradition of Frost at the Kennedy inaugural, and the tradition of poetry as a public event. You hear even in her reading right there all the sounds of Walt Whitman, that she has captured and made her own. That was a huge moment, both for African-Americans and for poets.
Colin McEnroe, Kalila Brown-Dean, and Matt Dorenzo, thank you so much for joining us here in the Whale House. Rest in peace, Maya Angelou. This is Where We Live.